if you're Santana fans out there, but I like his music. And his albums are very eclectic, if you will, because he has no normal, you know, front person for the band. So you get a variety. This is Michelle Branch singing a huge hit for them. It's a great song, in case you don't know. Joining me today from the East Coast is Emma. Emma, how are you?
Great, Mac. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me on.
No. The first of all, Emma and I met through mutual friends, and so we're gonna just leave your name as Emma for a variety of reasons. But the basis for our conversation was that she had seen post-traumatic winning a couple times. And so Emma's a former Marine officer and a spouse and of a Marine. And so wanted to have her on and talk to her about her experience relative to post-traumatic winning. So thanks for doing this.
It's my pleasure.
All right. First of all, we got to find out about you before we talk about that. So, born and raised where?
In Akron, Ohio. Little town outside of Akron, Ohio.
So, are you an Ohio State girl?
No. I want to make that very clear. Penn State, 100%.
Oh, so you were not pleased with the events of last night if you did watch them. Because Ohio State was down and then came roaring back in the second half of their game and hammered, I won't say hammered, but trounced Wisconsin pretty good. So you're sitting there just stewing in your own juices because Penn State got thumped by Ohio State as well.
That's right. A couple years in a row now, but that's okay. They'll come back.
Yeah, they have a good coach. Supposedly other people are interested in him.
Yes. Well, I hope he stays. I think he will. I just love Penn State. My dad grew up outside of State College and went to Penn State. He would take us to Penn State games, you know, when we were kids, and there's just nothing like it.
Really?
It's beautiful there.
Yeah. Happy Valley, right?
Yes.
Well, that guy's, I can't remember his name, but supposed to be a great coach, but he...
Franklin, yeah.
Yeah, he, supposedly USC was interested in him, and whether he said no or they said they were going to keep the guy that they have, they moved on. So, anyway, well, that's good. So, all right, so born in Ohio, talk to us about how does the Marine Corps get on your radar as a kid?
Well, not as a kid even. I was just about done finishing up my my degree at the University of Akron, and I received a letter from the OSO out of Kent State, and what caught my eye was a guaranteed seat at flight school if I would be able to pass the flight test before reporting to OCS. So that caught my eye, got my attention, and started working with the OSO.
The University of Akron, they're the ZIF.
Yeah, I never...
Wait.
Yes,
Akron
the
is ZIF,
the Akron ZIF.
ZIF.
Yes.
Could you explain that to us?
Unfortunately, I can't. I just know, unfortunately, the mascot is a kangaroo. And, I lived at home most of the time. It was like a commuter school,
right.
And put myself through college working full time. So I would take night classes when I needed to, just try to work my schedule to work full time, yet get through school.
So you have no idea how the origin of the nickname ZIF.
I can get back to you on that, but does anyone really want to know? I'm sure.
Well,
I'm sure
you hear it.
Story would know about it.
You hear it, and you're like, "What the hell is that?" And now that I'm even more intrigued, now that there's a kangaroo as a mascot. But for another time, maybe.
I know.
So you just saw in a random letter. Did you want to be a pilot growing up? What I mean, how does
I
connect the dots on
the
that?
Idea of it? But no, never. Never really thought about it seriously, a pilot, but it did catch my eye. And, having worked full time, like in a professional environment through school, I knew what lied ahead if I got out of school and started working. And I thought, you know, why not explore the option of doing something a little bit different? I don't come from a military family per se. I think I had a great uncle who was a Marine, and my grandfather was in the Navy during World War II for, you know, 4 years or so, right. But that was all. So, never had time to take the flight test or study for the flight test, but, I was taking a bunch of classes in the summer, and, drove down to Quantico 2 days after my 24th birthday and reported to Officer Candidate School.
Get out without, yeah. Okay. So, but you're supposed to get the training, but you haven't taken the flight physical. So then what? Do you take the flight physical before OCS? How did that
oh,
work?
No, I didn't even take the flight test. I was too busy with school and working, and I thought, well, flight school, it probably wasn't for me anyway. I mean, or definitely not for me anyway.
But I just went in ground.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that's interesting. All right. So, tell us about OCS. You don't have a big background in the Marine Corps. What did you think?
It was crazy. I went in completely blind. I remember driving down, you know, about 6 hour drive, and hesitating before driving through the main gate at Quantico. I knew as soon as I drove onto that base, that was it. My life would be changed forever, and indeed it was.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, everybody has the same gulping sensation, and I'm like you. I didn't come from a family that was a big military family. In fact, somebody sent me an email over the weekend and said, hey, you're born on December 7th, right? Your son's born on November 10th, so we all understand why you made him join the Marine Corps, right? And because I kind of did, but you can't make your kids join, I mean, even if you want to. But I kind of told Patrick, you don't have a choice, bro. You're November 10th, you're the son of a Marine, you got to join. Your brother's got a choice, you don't. He wasn't real pleased with that, but who cares? But the email said, you're born on December 7th. Why don't you join the Navy? And this is how people make impressions on people. When I was a kid, my dad managed the San Diego Padres. And I would sit in the bullpen. I was a teenager. I was in high school. And so I'd warm up the left fielder between innings and stuff like that. And otherwise sit there and I watch the game and you know, do whatever things that I needed to do to help out down there. And on Sunday, they would bring recruits in, I want to say the third phase of recruit training, they'd bring them to the baseball game. And they would sit up in the right field bleachers. And the Padre bullpen was in the left field corner. So you look straight across the stadium at the Marines. Up above and to the right of where we sat in the bullpen were recruits from the Naval Training Center back when they used to have one in San Diego. They had one in San Diego, one in Great Lakes, and they shut the one in San Diego down. So anyway, you would watch those recruits. And the Navy, those guys, I mean, they were having a party up there. They were having a great time. They were taking pictures. They were doing this. They were doing that. The recruits, they sat in their seats, right? They did. Right? I used to see this all the time, and it made such a huge impression on me. The drill instructors would be standing in the aisles, you know, with their Smokies on, and the recruits would be sitting there, you know, with their hands on their, you know, on their thighs. And they'd be watching the ball game, and there was no partying. People didn't go over there to talk to them. It was just them, a few sections away from anybody else, right, sitting there being Marines. And then they would, I want to say, in one of the later innings, they would play, you know, they'd play anchors away in the Marine hymn. And at the end of the Marine hymn, I mean, they would let it rip. And I watched that year after year after year, and it made such a huge impression on me in terms of, you know, what it was to be a Marine. And I think at the end of the day, that had as big effect as anything I ever read or anything that I ever was exposed to, was just watching the way they conducted themselves in public. And I was incredibly impressed. Let me ask you this. I mean, why did, did you go to talk to the other branches? Did you compare programs at all? Did you shop it around at all?
Not one bit. Not one bit. You know, I thought maybe, nah. I didn't know that the Coast Guard was an option, and I already had my degree, but Navy, no thank you. Army, absolutely not. Air Force,
whoa.
Yeah, they look for smart people. I mean, I was smart, but I wasn't looking for that type of, I don't know, challenge. So, no, it was either the Marine Corps or nothing. I watched a few stereotypical movies, and off I went.
What did you get your degree in?
International business.
Oh, all right.
And that was it. I wanted to travel. You know, I wanted to not stay in Northeast Ohio. As much as I love it there and I love my family, right. I knew I had to move away.
Got it. All right. So you gulp as you go through. And what was the experience of OCS like? I mean, for somebody who, you know, like me, I'd never been around that culture. I'd never seen this kind of craziness. What was it like for you?
No, a couple memories. I had about 3 seconds of, I don't know, comfort when we were doing the sea bag drag, and someone along, you know, one of the other people who were shipping out of the OSO office said, put your stuff, you know, when you drag your bag for the sea drag, put your stuff in plastic bags. So I have my, you know, whatever the packing list was, and it was, they were in those large Ziploc bags. And I remember one of the female sergeant instructors, my stuff fell out of my bag, and she's like, she said, are you prior enlisted? I said, no, sergeant instructor. And that was my 3 seconds of comfort that something knew that if they even thought for a second I could be prior, enlisted,
must be doing something
that
right.
I might, but that lasted for about 3 seconds, and then it was on with the craziness.
The welcome.
And I had never even, I wasn't a runner. I wasn't,
get out.
A gym person. I started running at the Metro Park, listening to, you know, songs and, you know, music, running music, as I trained for those few months before I went to OCS. So, yeah, it was a real eye opener.
All right,
in a lot of ways.
So you get through officer candidate school and you become a Marine officer. Then you head to the basic school. What do you become at the basic school and why?
Well, you put in your preferences, and back then, you know, everyone puts Intel as their first option. But I got through the basic school, and...
Now, what year is this?
Let's see. 1999, January of 99, I went to the basic
everybody
school.
Everybody puts Intel. Everybody puts grunts. So like, what are you crazy?
Well, you know, female, ladies, girls, okay. Whatever we are.
Right.
Yes, of course. Yeah. But no, TBS, January to June of 1999, and my roommate and I, we both put, as one of our, you know, second or third choices, whatever, a 7208 Air Support Control Officer. And I remember when we were all sitting there, and they're reading off, you know, last names and the, you know, the designators, 7208 Air Support. We both looked at each other, and we said, no. What the hell is that? we were so busy at OCS. They tried a consolidated schedule, and they did not continue that. But anyway, we were so busy. We looked at each other. We're like, now, wait a minute. What is that? So we had to go back to the book and see what exactly we would be doing for the Marine Corps. So that was funny.
So what is that?
Well, it's procedural control of aircraft. So when aircraft, fixed wing, rotary wing, lift off, you know, they talk to the air traffic control, whatever component, depending on where you are. And then ATC, switches you to the Direct Air Support Center or the DASC, and you brief the pilots on, artillery, where the units are briefly, you know, just to bring them up to date on anything that may have changed from, you know, their brief to when they take to the air.
Got it.
So, and then you switch them over to the forward air controller.
So are all those people the same MOS and just they're in different control centers? Or are there different people that have different MOSs?
Well, 7208, they're the ones that talk to the aircraft. You know, the 7210s, they're more with the radars. And then like I think it was the LAD officers, they were still 7208s, but you could go LAD. I forget how it
explained
how it
everybody
went back then.
Explain to everybody what LAD is.
A low altitude defense, something defense.
Air defense. Come on.
Two A's. I'm thinking two. I don't know why I'm thinking two D's, but yeah, low altitude air defense. So they're the ones with the vehicles with the missiles that are supposed to shoot down enemy aircraft.
Got it.
So out to air schools in 29 Palms for the warm, scorching summer of, you know, July through September of 1999. And it was great. it was 29 Palms.
Right. You'd never been to the desert like that, right?
No. But the good news was, and I think since October of 98 when I went to OCS, it was the first time we would go down to San Diego on the weekends and hang out at the queue at Coronado. And I began to think, all right, I could do this. You know, I mean, this was the first time that, you know, you almost felt human in a while. And you got to see the beautiful people down there in San Diego, Coronado. And it was fun. It was, you know, enjoyable, began to settle into what Marine Corps life might be.
Okay, all right. And then, so you finish your MOS school, and then where do you head after that?
Cherry Point. I was stationed at Mass 1 at Marine Air Control Group 28 at Cherry Point in the fall of 99, and began to work on, continued the training and the qualifications. And, you know, then as Marine Air Control Group Lieutenant, you have all the collateral duties. So just working on that.
All right. So how long did you do that? Were you on September 11th, 2001?
I was in Kosovo on the MEU. So in addition to the various exercises, and you'd go out on little exercises at Camp Lejeune, stay in the field. I chopped to the MEU in 2001. We floated April to October, and again, prior to that, you have all the workups. But so it was the last Libo cruise to the Med, where we got to go to all the ports that the MEUs used to get to go to, briefly, but no, on 9/11, we were in Kosovo, and I thought, oh my God, here we go. I couldn't believe it. But our MEU didn't go. We were towards the end of our time. We didn't go into Afghanistan. It was the next MEU that went in. So we went home, and 2002 prepped for what would be OIF-1.
All right. And so did you deploy to support OIF-1?
Yeah. My commitment was coming to an end, and I extended, to participate in that. It was during that time I met my husband. And
who's a Marine?
He was a Marine, and again extended. So I wasn't gonna be in for 3 or 4 years and then leave the party before everything got started.
Right.
So that was 2002. We had a brief courtship. We're married in 2002, and then deployed, the invasion a couple months later in 2003.
So, and what are you doing at the time?
I was stationed in Kuwait. By this time, after the MEU, I went to MTACS 28. And so I
Hold on. What is that? What is that?
Marine Air. I have to have the acronym, but the Marine Air Tactical Command Center.
Got it. And what were you? And so what were you doing?
So we worked in the Tactical Air Command Center, part of the air wing, and we set up in Kuwait. So I was at Al-Jabr.
Okay, so hold on, just so I know, because I've dealt with those people. So in the TAC, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Who do you work for? Who do you work for inside that? Do you work for the TAO? Are you in support of that guy?
I was. In Kuwait, I worked for the Close Battle Cell, UK. So I worked with the Brits for Close Battle Cell.
And so
for the march up.
What is that, like current ops, close battle?
Yes.
What, okay,
yep.
So you're doing current ops. And you're in a Brit COC or you're an LNO to them?
It was, they were kind of LNOs to us. We were all co-located.
Got it. All right. Well, interesting. Tell me something unique about the Brits and how they do aviation.
They're awesome. They were
awesome.
They?
Really?
They were just great guys and, you know, very proficient, very professional. And, they were a pleasure to work with.
Well, not everybody's like that. Well, that's good to know. Good to know. All right. So tell me about the march up. You're in Kuwait. What was that like?
It was good. It was hard, you know, 13, 14 hour days on crew. You know, you'd come in early to brief and you would sit for 12, you know, you would sit the position for 12 hours and you would, do your job. You would communicate with the ground units, the air as much as you could, as much as you needed to. You would pass information. Again, I kind of forgot, but remember, it was all about WMD back then. So a couple times a day you would, the sirens would go off, and sometimes you would, if you weren't the, you know, designated personnel to stay, you would run out, you'd mop up and run out to the bunker until the all clear was given. I remember getting mopped up and typing with pencils, you know, through those ridiculous gloves to get the word out.
Were you good at mop gear? A lot of people were not. Were you good?
Well, I mean, my yes, sure. I mean, I'm not gonna. I don't want to be the one that is sitting there flopping around. I mean, but yeah, they told me to put it on. I put it on. I didn't like it, but I put it on.
Got it. Let's see. All right. So you do the march up. Give me a couple lessons learned, leadership lessons out of your experience during the march up.
I think it was just be a team player. You know, I mean, again, I as an officer in the air wing, you don't have the privilege of having a lot of Marines under you. I mean, yeah, you work with, you know, a corporal or a lance corporal here or there, and you watch after them and take care of them, make sure they have what they need. But it's more individual. So, you know, I would say just be a team player. Be a hard worker. You know, it was kind of back then, well, I'm sure it still is, it was the East Coast and the West Coast. And, you know, so there were a little, I don't know what you call it, rivalry or whatever, but why wouldn't you just come together and work as hard as you can?
We eventually do that, but it doesn't mean we don't talk shit about each other.
Right. Yes. Right. No, it was great. It was hard work. It was stressful. And again, I was married at that time, so it was snail mail. You would number, you know, those were the days where you numbered your letters, because you could get letter four before you get letter one, or however the mail worked back then. So in terms of communicating with my husband, I would read the casualty reports and pray not to like see his name or his like SSN or something.
Yeah,
so,
you would have access to that stuff before.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So that was interesting. I remember listening to BBC on a little tiny radio that I had, and it, you know, just being isolated like that. I think things have changed now a little bit, but there wasn't like a mess hall where they had TVs or radio. You know, just to hear something live on the radio was kind of refreshing. It's like, oh yeah, there's a whole world. You know, there's a whole rest of the world.
In the op center that you worked in, they didn't have, you know, they didn't have TVs up, or they didn't have any of that.
They did in the op center. Like, you know, they would monitor the news.
Right.
I remember we all came in and watched. I think it was the Jessica Lynch rescue or something.
It was a big to-do, of course.
And so we kind of watched that. And those things just took a. I mean, not that, but I mean news, and we would watch the news. But you know, what was going on in the news and what we were dealing with, you had to stay focused on what you were dealing with, what was in front of you. And
so, but you as a spouse have a little bit different perspective because your husband is northwest of you, right? Doing stuff. So you have kind of your attention is a little bit split in that, is he still alive? Is he okay? Blah, 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 blah. So interesting. When you think back about that whole experience, as a human being, as a leader, what was your major takeaway from that?
Well, I mean, I was extremely proud. Not everyone gets to deploy for a major campaign like that. So I was just happy to have been there, happy to have gone there, to have done my job. And really happy to come home too, because we lost too many wonderful Marines, sailors, service members. So happy to have done it. What an experience!
Yeah, interesting. So you come home and do you get out?
I did.
What happens next?
EAS in 2003, you know, that initial push was one of the shorter deployments. I think he was home in, 5 or 6 months. I was home in 4 to 5 months. We kind of got in there and then handed it over. So I EAS'd and he got orders to be an instructor at Officer Candidate School. So we headed up to Quantico. I worked on active duty special work, or ADSW, for the Marine for Life program that was new at that time, 2004-ish. And I was back in uniform, full-time, full benefits, and doing that as he was at Officer Candidate School, working, 6, 7-hour days a week, and he was busy.
No kidding. When do you become done with the Marine Corps? What year?
I resigned my commission in 2005 after I'd had my first boy, my first child, our first child. I had intended to just drill. I was off ADSW by the time I had him, but I intended to drill with the IMA debt, in that capacity. And I got a package from, the Marine Corps Reserve Forces out of New Orleans that said, what's your plan if you both get deployed? And I thought, I'm not going to put myself in a position where if things change, as they do in the reserves, where I would have to leave, my child. And again, my husband, he was going to stay in. So someone had to be the steady for the family. And it was just a no-brainer that would be me.
Right.
So I resigned my commission just so I didn't have to have that hanging over my head.
Talk to me about so you do that, and how do you cross paths with post-traumatic learning?
Well, as I began my transition into motherhood and being a spouse and a dependent, if you will, that was not an easy transition. Like I said, he was working at OCS. And I didn't see him as much, managed to have, two kids 2 years apart, 2005 and 2007. And it was just lonely, super, super lonely. And I didn't realize it at the time, but during that time of, having the kids and figuring out what motherhood and marriage and as a spouse in the Marine Corps meant, I totally lost sight of myself. And there was no self-care going on. I know it's kind of a buzzword, but, I failed to keep something for myself. And, like, anything. we never lived on base, so I was a little bit isolated down in Spotsylvania at the time. Right. And I just completely lost sight of who I was. It was hard with, the two babies. And I don't know. So I think that's when it really hit me that, wait a minute, this is in no way according to the pamphlet. Like, something's missing. Something isn't right. With young kids, you don't have the time to get out or volunteer. It wasn't easy to justify paying for childcare because I would worry about the kids, and just kind of snowballed. The kids weren't used to it, to being away from me, and I wasn't used to being away from them. So it just became easier not to do it.
Got it. So keep going. So you have that going on in your life, and then what?
That just wasn't, it wasn't healthy, kind of losing your identity. It's not healthy for me. It's not healthy for the kids. I mean, in one way, my boys and I, we are so close, and I think raising kids in this day and age, that will pay off, because they know that I will be here for them. They know that they can tell me anything. But at the time, like I said, it's isolating and depressing. And maybe that was just related to my tendency to maybe being depressed or anxious. But I think it happens a lot. I think it's really common with military spouses and women in general. But back to being unhealthy, it was also for my husband. It was unhealthy for my husband and I. Since he was gone so much, I got everything I needed from the kids. And we kind of fell into a cycle of, he didn't have much to give, and I didn't need much from him. So that's not a good recipe for a great marriage. But it happens. And
it happens to a lot of marriages, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and
definitely,
it's the way that you do it, though. This is the way we do it. This is the way our friends do it, and you kind of get into that mode, but I don't think until something makes you step back and look at it, do you say, holy shit, like, what have we done? There's that old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. With all the best of intentions, trying to make sure that, we do our jobs and we support each other and this culture of the mission comes first and everything else comes later. All of a sudden you look up one day and you're like, wait a minute, there's so much distance here. This is not a good thing. So keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I mean, that's so common, and it tends to be something we don't talk about a whole lot at first until you're bothered by it, and then you say something to somebody and you find out that they're dealing with the exact same stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to be willing to open up and share. You have to find those people that you can have that conversation with. But in the end, like you said, we were united in that the purpose behind his dedication, to his job.
Right.
And that was to basically save the lives of the Marines by giving them the knowledge and the tools they need to take care of business and do what they need to do.
Right.
So we have that, and I'm very proud of that. Our sacrifice contributed to that.
I have to say this, though. A lot of good marriages, right, get destroyed under that premise. That isn't good. I mean, and so you hear military spouses, both male and female, right, whether you're the active duty spouse or the non-active duty spouse, you hear them say that, like, I understand how important the job is, blah, 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 right? And so you understand how the strain that marriages get put under because, there is this, very, very important mission that goes on, and everybody wants to support that. But at the same time, your marriage is important, too.
You're trying to live your life, and people, I refer to the pamphlet sometimes, and it is not according to the pamphlet in any way. This isn't what I thought it was going to be like. This isn't what marriage is supposed to be like. This isn't what motherhood and parenting, sometimes feels like being a single parent.
Sometimes, for long stretches.
Yeah, as I say, a single parent not allowed to date, but for that paycheck, you know what I'm
right.
saying?
All the downside. Yeah. So tell me how. So you're going through that. What are the other things that lead you to post-traumatic warning and have that thing hit with such a thud relative to you?
Well, let's see here. I mean, I refer to it as like having some, like being a card-carrying member of like certain traumatic experiences, like in a joking, not in a joking way, but
you can joke. We don't care.
Okay, but so I would say from a if you talk about trauma in my life, I would say it started. Maybe I was 6 to 8 years old, and there was domestic violence in my house. My mom and dad would fight, and you know, physically hitting, and all of that. And it was terrifying as a young kid, seeing your parents do that. It was hard. It was scary. So yeah, I remember one time they were fighting, and my brother, who was a year younger than I was, we picked up the phone, dialed that rotary dial, you know, and tried to call the police. And my dad, then there was my dad. And it was like, and we're going to hang up the phone. And anyway, we scurried off to the bedroom, and that was that. But, you know, just things like that, you remember and you can't forget because it's not right. It's harmful. But my mom, she had been sexually abused by her father when she was a young girl, and abused alcohol, was an alcoholic. That just took a toll on her. She was a broken person who never got or received the help that she would have needed to heal herself from her demons.
No, and you know, it's horrible, right? You read and you, now I hear stories like that all the time, and you know, and then you know, the simple truth of post-traumatic winning, you know, helps so many people to go through that stuff. When you tell them there's nothing wrong with you, you know, what you're going through is absolutely normal for, you know, what you've gone through in your life. And so you don't need to apologize for it. You don't need to be embarrassed about it. You know, you don't need to be any of that. And they look at you like, who are you? Like, you know, what is this? It's like, look, it's just the truth. It is just the truth. And so it's really interesting. It's really interesting, in my opinion, as you meet so many people, as I meet so many people that struggle with the same issues, but they struggle alone. And you know, they may or may not have gone to therapy, and the therapist may or may not have been helpful. And that's not a knock on therapists. It's just, you know, a therapy is a two-way street. There's a patient component and there's a therapist component. And sometimes it doesn't always sometimes it doesn't always work great. But I would tell you this, that by and large, most people struggle alone. There's no high school class, there's no college class, there's no online class. You know, nobody's, you know, running to sign up for the community class on how to deal with trauma because it doesn't exist. And so, as a result, most people are groping, you know, in the dark by themselves trying to figure it out. And your mom, obviously, one of those people.
Yep, absolutely. So there was that. They were divorced, separated and divorced when I was maybe first grade. And they got back together and then remarried when she got pregnant with my younger sister, who's 9 years younger than I am. So, yeah, they get back together and there's, you know, things are decent, semi-functional and all. And a year later, they had my baby brother. And yeah, things were good, kind of, you know. And then,
but the effect on you, though, you still, obviously, you can't forget what's happened in the past. So anytime there's a kerfuffle or a hiccup or something like that, right, you go to white knuckles?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, you know, and as I've learned through the years, living in that environment, it makes you very prone to anxiety and depression as the child, you know, as the kid. So, yeah, just kind of living under a cloud of unknown. It wasn't, I don't know, you never knew what was going to happen. But yeah, a couple decent years, I guess, and then the wheels began to come off. I think I was 13, 14, and my mom started drinking heavily, and she met someone and left my dad and us four kids. So the stress in the house was just off the charts between the drinking and the fighting and just the dysfunction and my younger sister and brother being there and me trying to be, you know, as the oldest child, you know, protect them. It was awful. So my dad, yeah, she wasn't going to take us to be with this person.
Right.
And so my dad said, yeah, you know, I'll take him, which sounds odd, but I mean, but to that point, my dad wasn't the hands-on doting father. He was more he was a provider, but he worked a lot. And, you know, I get that made my mom feel lonely and all that. But, so she left. And when I was 16, then in addition to being a daughter and a sister, I became a wife and a mother to my 6 and 8 year old brother and sister, and a wife, not in a weird way, but just in a companion way to my father. I mean, we did it together, largely. I mean, again, I was going to high school and working, and but we did it together. So she left, and at times, I use the word flaming alcoholism, you know, with stints in rehab and just not knowing. I remember at that time I had a pager, and just living, again, under that cloud of unknown and fear that something bad's going to happen, you know, with her behavior and codependency on this person and substance, alcohol, something was bound to happen. But so as she entered, you know, kind of deeper into the codependency, I was in high school, and again, just helping out with my younger brother and sister. But yeah, so that was that. My dad, you know, he was very strict with my older, you know, with the two older kids. But, you know, over a short period of time when we were together after he had, I'm thinking about this now, it's like he agreed to take custody of us. It sounds so odd, but that's how it felt back then. But we grew together, you know, and we forged ahead. Times were tough and stressful, but I remember having to look at my little brother and sister, who were like the cutest things ever, that they'd be getting ready to go with mom for the weekend for visitation, and I'd have to look at them and tell them, she's not coming. You know, she's, you know, if she was on a bender or something, she wasn't coming to pick them up, and they would be upset, but it was heartbreaking. And yeah, and all the while, myself being heartbroken, but then knowing my dad was heartbroken. So,
So took care of him. Dysfunction on top of dysfunction on top of dysfunction. And
kind of.
And trying to make it, so you don't sound like you had much of a childhood. There wasn't time for you to be a child.
Nope. There wasn't. But so, you know, there would be times where we wouldn't hear from her, along with her, you know, along with her family. I mean, she comes from a big family, and I have, you know, cousins after cousins, and, a big, wonderful family. But, yeah, that guy she was with, he was abusive, and it was just hard. So, one day I was 19 or 20. I got a call from like her sister and said, you know, we haven't heard from her. We haven't been able to get a hold of her in a while. And at this point I wasn't really speaking with her just because. And it just wasn't healthy. And, you know, with the alcoholic, you, at a point, you just have to,
no, I mean,
they cut them off, but
it's
you have to do what's best for you.
Well, you know, it's one of the things I say in post-traumatic winning is that, you know, it sucks, you know, but not everybody grows up in a Disney family. And I read Kyle Carpenter, who's a Medal of Honor recipient. One of the headlines about his book I saw was, you know, one of the things, piece of advice he gives is, you know, talk to your mom more. And I thought, well, yeah, I mean, that's awesome advice if you got one, right?
Right.
Because not everybody has them. And so, you know, people that don't grow up in a family like that can't fathom, you know, having to push, you know, people that you're biologically related to away and keep them at arm's distance because they've just done that kind of damage in your life. And so, but there's a lot of people out there. And you know, one thing I think that I've come to realize doing post-traumatic winning is how many, especially, you know, young people that come from, they come from these terrible, you know, circumstances. And, you know, and it sucks, man. They live in, you know, and then they don't have the same, they may or may not have, you know, quality coaches and different people in their lives. And so, you know, things that we think, you know, happen don't really happen. And you don't realize how devastating it is. Or maybe you do realize how devastating it is. But I don't think I did. I don't think I realized how bad that problem is for young people today when, you know, what, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce. And then they may or may not have good mentors or they may or may not be in a program that does mentoring for them and things like that. And so to me, one of the things that I've learned is that, you know, so many young people are starving for leadership in their life, starving for it. And a lot of us come in the military looking for exactly that. We want people to strong people, and we gravitate to organizations like the Marine Corps looking to change our lives and wanting to be surrounded by much better people. And that comes from, you know, this a painful, you know, where a pain, like the things people take so for granted, like Thanksgiving and Christmas. Well, for people that don't come from Disneyland families, right? You know, it's a roll of the dice because it's not all the memories are very pleasant, right?
No, not at all. No, and I mean, thankfully, thank God, I've always been a very strong person, just a strong-willed person. You know, my aunt would tell me a story. When I was little, 2-3 years old, I would stand up to my dad. He would tell me to do something. I would put my hands on my hips and kind of look up at him like, you know, and she says, I would come through the room and scoop you up because I didn't, you know, you didn't cross my dad in those days. And, I didn't know any better, but I just knew I didn't like what I was hearing out of him, whether it was about a toy or what he wanted me to do or whatever. But I do. I thank God that I'm a strong person. I know that. And I know not everyone is. But I come from some pretty hardy stock, you know, from both sides of the family. Tough, strong people. But you know, maybe in some ways that's not the greatest thing. Always, but it definitely helped me to make it through and to be successful and to kind of accomplish anything I've ever set out to do. So again, I'm very thankful for that. So back to trauma number, I don't know, but as I was saying, we hadn't heard from her in a while, and I go over to his house. for the first time, and knock on the door, and he answers, and I said, I want to see my mom. Where is she? Is she okay? I want to see my mom. And he said, no, get out of here. Whatever. I said, I was upset.
And how,
I said, I want to see her.
And how old are you?
Like 19,
okay.
20.
Right.
So I was working and going to school. And he picked me up. It was January. And he picked me up by my coat, and he threw me off the porch. It's like 5 or 6 steps. But I landed on my feet, and I was shocked, you know. And I was taking night classes at the time, so I had pepper spray in my mace in my pocket, and I pulled it out and I tried to spray him with it, and it was windy, and he didn't get any of the pepper spray, unfortunately. But he came down and grabbed me and picked me up, big guy, and slammed me onto the ground. This is January in Northeast Ohio. I mean, the ground, I don't know if it was frozen, but it sure felt like it was. And rolled around, picked me up, lifted me up, and slammed me on the ground again. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, God, this isn't good. Everything was going slow in my head, but I thought, that can't happen again. Like, I need to not be thrown to the ground again. And so I, was just like rolling around trying to make it hard for him to pick me up again. And I, scurried away and sped off and got to a payphone and called 911. And, I was hurt. My neck was injured, like acute bilateral cervical strain or whatever. So, whatever. But so I thought we would get him. I thought we would. That would be what would get my mom away from him and give him what he deserved in terms of, just for being the terrible person that he was,
right.
Press charges, all of that. He was a policeman at the hometown there. So.
Wait. He's a policeman.
Yeah. He was. And, so. Needless to say, even though we filed charges, nothing ever came of it, and it came down to he said, she said, and my mother would have had to have testified
right.
on what had happened. And I don't know that she saw or not. I don't know. I don't know where she was. I don't know what she saw. I think she may have seen it. I don't know. And but she didn't. So she was that ill with her addiction that she wouldn't even testify for her oldest daughter, who had been assaulted by her boyfriend at the time. So that was rough. But really what I remember realizing, in the weeks after was, oh my goodness, the difference between men and women and the just how they're made strength wise. If someone wants to take power over you, overpower you, they can do it if they are larger and stronger. And if you are not equipped with the self-defense, whatever, wherewithal that you would need to defend yourself. So, I think of people who have been assaulted or raped or, whatever. I just remember feeling that feeling of helplessness when someone wants to overpower you. And it was, so that was scary. But anyway, so that continued our estrangement, shall we say. And again, time goes on, a few more years, and, we eventually, my mother and I, we eventually, reconciled, she sobered up and she got away from him and led, she, was working and had several relatively healthy years. Again, having never sought the treatment that she, or not the treatment, but the help she needed to be truly well. She was doing good. She had her own apartment, and we kind of re-established our relationship. So, I had a child by then, and I wanted her to be part of that. And I forgave her for everything in the past. you know, we had a decent relationship. So in 2006, we were in Virginia Station, had the baby, and he was about a year old. And we go up to Ohio for Christmas, which we don't spend many Christmases in Ohio because whatever. But I'm like, yeah, this will be nice. You know, mom's doing good. Dad's doing good. You know, mom's in her apartment. Dad's in his house. And have the baby. It just, you know, it'll be nice. Mom's doing good. Whatever. So go home. And I don't know. My siblings knew. And at this time, my two brothers and sister, they still all lived right around there. And turns out my mom and dad had gotten back to things. And my dad would go over and stay at my mom's apartment, and they would, you know, they were kind of dating or whatever. And my siblings didn't want to tell me because, again, I had kind of sacrificed, my teenage and young adult years in an effort to take care of them instead of doing whatever normal people do. And, kind of everything that I had grew up knowing was based on the fact that mom and dad can't be together. They're, you know, terrible for one another. And sure enough, I don't know how I got wind of it or just something was odd. And, found out that they were dating. And I just remember feeling so betrayed that, wait a minute. So what was all of that about? What was all that for? you guys are gonna date? So anyway, that was a rough one. But anyway, so we went home a little early that year, and that was that. So I adjusted to the fact that, you know, they were back together in whatever capacity, and that was life, you know, moving on. I had my own family to deal with and to try to enjoy. So, you know, we moved on. But, and then again, over then a few more years, you know, they would get together and they would get not back together and blah, blah, blah. And things again were up and down with alcohol and this and that. But in, April of 2002, she had, by this time, you know, she had moved back in with my dad for a while, and then she moved out, got her own apartment. You know, we thought she was doing good, working. But in April of 2002, she committed suicide. She took a bunch of pills, and that was it. She was gone. And remember, she called. She called me the Saturday prior. So it was like 4 days before I think she did it. And we had some friends over and we were playing a game and the phone rang and it was her. And I didn't usually answer when she called, you know, just was busy. But especially on a Saturday night, it was just odd. But something just, I answered the phone and we had a great conversation. I was in a good mood. She was in a good mood. And I didn't think much of it. And sounded like she was having a good day, but that would be the last time I talked to my mom. So my brother called. So a couple days, you know, passed. My brother called, and he had found her, and my sister, you know, also came to the apartment and found her as they were taking her away. And so by that night, all four kids were together. By the end of the day. In Ohio, I came up from North Carolina, and my brother came from California. He was in the Air Force at this time, and it was just sad, very sad, traumatic time. You go through the whys and the what ifs, and it's terrible. But at some point, you have to stop with the what ifs and the whys and you know, that's the really crappy thing about suicide are it's the people who get left behind, they never get those answers. So it's just heartbreaking,
and the questions never go
devastating.
Away. Right, the questions never go away because the event never goes away because the pain never goes away, and so the questions are always there. So that happens in what year?
2012. So over 7 years ago now. Okay. So, but you know, I had my family, and just, you know, thank God, just because of everything that we have been through, I'm so close with my brothers and sister and their husband and wife, you know. So we had each other, and we had my dad, you know. He was heartbroken, but we had each other, and I have my nieces and nephews, and I'm so thankful for that. So yeah, we're making it through. You know, she was very unwell, and
well, I mean,
but no.
A lifetime of unwell, right?
I mean, right.
That's what.
Right.
That's what's hard. So you walk in to see post-traumatic winning, and how'd you hear about it, and what did you think? You probably, you know, not unfamiliar with things like that. I think as many people that live through traumatic experiences like you have, you know, you kind of poke around looking for different things to see if they can help. Explain how you cross paths with post-traumatic winning.
My husband called. I think he had seen it that morning, and he called and said, "You have to come see this. This is, you know, he knows,
right.
Of course, the story, you know, my childhood and whatnot." But he said, "No, you really need to see this. This is important." I said, "Okay." So I went down with some friends, and I mean, yeah, sure. I've seen counselors and psychologists, whatever, over the years, and it just kind of always goes to the same place. And I go through, you know, hash through the story, and okay, but post-traumatic winning, it was just different. I think it hit me like a brick wall when it said, you know, when you told your story of, "You're not going to get over this." It's like, wait a minute. That's right. I'm not, clearly, you know, there are these things I'm not going to get over. And that's okay. So what I loved about it was, and I thought about it so much over the months, was I think post-traumatic winning, when you tell people, you're not going to get over it. It's how you deal with it. And your, you know, the 10 commandments, the 3 goals, it's perfect that, I feel it gives a person the license to deal with it, to deal with their traumas and to move on, you know, to make that decision daily. Okay. Well, yeah. Well, how am I going to react? What is my behavior going to be, you know, when I think about this or whenever I'm bothered by this? So I just think it gives people the license to deal with their trauma and to move on. And I think that's what was different for me than going through the counselors, trying to read books, trying to, you know, deal with it on our own. So, yeah, it was just a real blessing for me to be able to see that. And, yeah, I think about it all the time.
What? Talk to me about, you saw it again in August?
Yes. Well, this time, you know, I do a lot of volunteering.
Right.
With the unit and with other Marine Corps efforts. But I was trying to get all the spouses that I could to come see it. And I just think people are kind of, yeah, all the other efforts, which, you know, not to speak poorly of them at all. I mean, they have their own, I don't know, merit, but because it was so important to me. And again, you know, I'm a card carrying member of several different types of trauma that, I just wanted the word to get out. And so I went because I invited all the spouses from the unit. I invited all the spouses from another group that I, you know, volunteer with. So yeah, I was going to be there. And I could just hear it over and over. It just, both times I left feeling calm, uplifted, happy, and like I wasn't alone. So I really liked that.
Do you talk to me about, is there any, is you mentioned the part that you're not going to get over that. You know, interestingly enough, somebody asked me last week, like, where did you hear that? And I said, well, my company Gunny is the one that told me that. And I said, I know not everybody has a guy like that in their life. I said, and as I look back, I'm very fortunate. I'm very fortunate to have, you know, had somebody like that around when I went through what I went through. And I said, so, you know, these, that whole presentation is little snippets from different people that I've encountered along the way of my life who've given me, and then other parts of it are just trying to figure it out. And they said, well, it's really interesting. And that, but that probably, and what I find interesting is people comment about that the most. Why has nobody ever told me that I would never get over it? Because it's almost, at first it sounds daunting, right? And then it's comforting because then Yes. You know there's nothing wrong with you.
Right. And I say that it almost gives them like the permission to really look at it and to not move past it, but it's almost like prior to getting that little tidbit of information that you're never going to get over it, you're looking for something that has to happen before you start to deal with it. Whether it's, I don't know, a counselor or I don't know, you know, because people don't find it because it's not there. I just think that, yeah, they need to just say, yeah, go ahead, you know. You're not going to get over it. You might as well just learn how to exist with it in a healthy, positive way, you know, which is post-traumatic learning. So, yeah.
No, it is amazing. What when you, you know, I don't know that until you go through something like that, it's really hard. I characterize it as when you're traumatized and you live on those pins and needles for years, that is not an easy life.
It's
people wonder, well, how could this be like this or how could that be like that? And you want to say, oh, I can tell you, you know, when you live like that for years and years and years, and it's a thousand razor cuts to your heart and then a few pretty decent stab wounds too. I don't think people can rightly understand it. People that would be listening that have gone through something like you have had, which is prolonged childhood trauma, and then you said one of them is your mother's suicide. Do you give advice?
I don't know. No, I mean, you just have to go, you have to be strong. You just have to, if you're not strong, you have to get strong, I guess. And you just have to keep going. You just have to keep going day after day. Things will change. Things will get better. Things will change. That's a guarantee. And they can't be bad forever. You do have to reach out. But that's hard. It's almost like you have to be prepared to reach out and then a lot of times not get what you need from professionals or from friends even, from relationships. But you have to keep trying and reaching out because, you know, if you don't, it's just too easy to fall into that depression and loneliness and isolation. And
I think it's the isolation piece. Because depression, I don't think is a having a tough day. I think depression there's a clinical diagnosis for that. And so people would use it like you use it, right? Like you go through this depression thing. Well, I would say it's technically not depression, right? But it's this down part of your life, okay? How do you get through it? What do you say when this thing comes back over and over and over and over?
Right?
And you can't get away from it. And so it's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. And so I it's interesting. Well, now you have some direction to help people and point them with. So you know the requirement for post-traumatic winning is you got to help other people. Have you done that?
I think I have, definitely. And I know that I'll be able to continue to do so. I know my family will listen to this interview, and they'll appreciate it. I have friends that'll listen to it and appreciate it, I think. And, hopefully other people will stumble upon it and learn something. And I'm happy to chat. there's the details. Oh, my goodness. So much. But, I'm happy to talk with anyone who wants to talk or anything.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Anything that I haven't been smart enough to ask you, Emma, that you want to share with people? I mean, not having a childhood like most of us would look, back on and say that we had, the ups and downs of being the child of somebody who's got some pretty substantial problems and going that through with them and then ultimately experiencing their suicide. Anything that I haven't been smart enough to ask you that you want people to know?
Well, I just think it's important, and it kind of sneaks up on you, but and it goes along with your 10th commandment, the wellness practices. Don't lose yourself. Keep something for yourself. As you go through a transition or, whether it's into motherhood or into after a trauma, don't lose yourself. Keep something for yourself and find something that fulfills you. Even I found being a mother, not having to worry about, I have a great life. It's wonderful. I'm so thankful to be able to stay home with my boys and raise them and be here for them, to be there for my husband. And but I found after years of thinking, what is missing? What is not according to the pamphlet was I wasn't fulfilled as a person. And I looked it up on the definition of unfulfilled. Not having fully utilized or exploited one's abilities or character. And that was exactly it. And I think that would resonate with a lot of women, a lot of military spouses in general, that we feel guilty that just momming it is not fulfilling. We think that in and of itself is supposed to be fulfilling. And if you've lost yourself, if you haven't kept something for yourself, it's frustrating, but it's okay to be unfulfilled. As a stay-at-home mom.
I think the significance of this class is that when you do talk about wellness and you do talk about what it's like to be damaged and for those people that do go through trauma. All of a sudden you look around and it's like, I'm not alone in this room. I know. And the next thing is that I know there's a lot of other people, that are going through the same things. And it's been pretty interesting, some of the things that people have said after this. And it gives me what I needed. And I just think there's so much steam that gets let out of the balloon after you know, that after the presentation, because it's like this truth, after this truth, after this truth, after this truth. The second comment I hear the most after, why didn't anybody tell me that, right, is I thought you were talking to me the whole time.
Right.
It felt like you were speaking to me because that's my life. Those are all the things that I've dealt with. And it's amazing how many people will either come up to me afterwards and say that, or send me an email or text afterwards and say, hey, I don't really want to come up and talk to you, but it felt like you were talking straight to me the whole time. And then I always say, I was, motherfucker. I was talking straight to you. And they start laughing. I said, no. I mean, do you hear when Matt Kiker says, you know, talks about his father committing suicide and you know, his friend in sixth grade hung himself, and then his brother commits suicide, and then he goes home to bury his brother, that he finds out that his brother was having sex with his fiancée. And I said, did you hear the part where he says, and I want you to know that if you have similar things like I do, right, there's a better place for you. And the last person I said that to looked at me and said, I thought he was talking straight to me. I said, he is, man.
Yeah.
He is. You're not alone in this. There's so many people sitting in that room who wouldn't put their hand up, who won't say shit, but have gone through similar stuff. And so you are not abnormal, man. Everything you're going through is perfectly normal given your life experience. And I don't think, right, and I don't think, and you're a great case of this, Emma, I don't even think you realized what a damaged human being you were after year after year after year after year after year, right, of being part of the shit show.
Right.
And when life is like that, and it is for some people, and I don't think we realize it, and then all of a sudden you sit in a class like that, that is just truth after truth after truth after truth, and I think there's this incredible decompressive effect that comes on the backside of that, of that class for people that have lived it, and I think that's a great one. And then the other thing is, I hope, is that it gives them hope that not only can you live a good life, you can live a great life, but it's not going to be through, you know, you're not going to get to great through prescription medications, although they could be part of getting there. And you can't talk, how do you talk your mother's suicide? How do you talk your lost childhood into a good event? And the answer is you can't. So how do I get to good? And the answer is the only way you get to good is you have to give of yourself and you have to change other people's lives. And you have to use the things that have happened to you for the good. And when you do that, I can tell you for 1,000% true that you'll transform your own life. And so to me, I just my experience in all this has been something I didn't anticipate. This is not what I thought would happen. And it's been almost this magical experience for me. And you're one of those people that is case in point. You're like me. You're living with this stuff, and right, you put on a brave face. And I have four kids. And what are you going to do? Quit on them? Well, you can't do that.
No.
But at the same time, you feel alone, I think, at certain times, and you don't talk about certain things because you know you're a parent now. You're supposed to, you know, be tough and get after this. And so I think that's why. That's why I can't do this often enough. That's why, you know, I did it four times in a day, you know, not too long ago. And somebody said, oh my God, you know, it's like 2.5 to 3 hours. How did you? And I said, no, it's the easiest thing to get motivated in the world. Because you just know, you know. And I saw my daughters, we went to dinner last night for my birthday, and I was telling my daughters, you know, I can tell the people in the audience that have been significantly impacted by trauma. And they look at me and they're like, how? I said, because of the way they pay attention. Because they will move their heads to see things, right? And they don't take their eyes off the screen the whole time. And so, for whatever reason, they catch my eye. And I said, most recently, I was over in Yuma. At the end of it, I looked at this Marine, and his command kind of got everybody together. And I walked over to their group, and it was probably about 50 Marines. And I'd spoken to the commanding officer a little bit earlier in the presentation during one of the breaks. And I said, "Excuse me for 1 second. I need to talk to you." I pointed. I didn't know his name. He's a corporal. I said, "I need to talk to you when you're all done." And he looks around and he's like, "Me?" I said, "Yeah, you." And so he came up afterwards. And he looks at me and goes, "Hey, Mac," and he introduced himself. And I said, "Why were you so interested?" And he looked at me and he said, "I've lived this. I live this, and I want to help other people in my family because we've struggled with it." He said, "Was it that obvious?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely. No. And so you can tell. And so, like I said, it's just, and I don't think there's another way out. I mean, you can... You know, if all you're going to do is what you were doing and what I used to do, which was the endurance piece of this, that's pretty rough. That's a pretty rough road.
Oh, that's a tough go. No, it is.
Yeah.
It is.
That's a tough go.
No, but those people that you do reach, they will be the ones, whether they come up to you afterwards or not, they'll be the ones that are charged with spreading, the ideas of post-traumatic winning. And getting the word out and helping people, because if you're hurt, you can identify it in other people.
And you don't have to. I tell stories all the time. You don't have to try very hard, because it just straight up finds you. And I mean, that's what happens to me all the time now. I don't have to go looking for it. it locates me in some way, shape or form. And all I do is say the same thing I do the same thing that I tell everybody to do, which is I look at them and say, "Hey man, you got a minute? Can I talk to you?" And it starts this really cool experience for me, because I'm going to help them, I'm going to help them. And so, yeah.
No, you're exactly right. Whether it's in any way I help people, it makes me happy. That's just part of my personality, but helping people makes me happy. I think it makes anyone happy. You get that feeling of, yeah, I kind of brighten that person's day.
The other thing is this, I think for all of us that have lived through different parts of this, this has different phases to it, right? I don't even know how to say this right, but when you have lived through this, it's not an insignificant part of your life. It's been a huge piece of your life. And then when you can get in bed at night and you can look up at the ceiling and know that you've helped somebody else through this thing that is so significant in your life, I struggle to find a more happier place that I go to than that. I don't know that I go to a happier place than that.
No, I don't think you would, because you're helping them. They're helping other people. But what about their kids? What if, I'm going to be a better person to my children. That's going to make them right. Better people. And as opposed to passing on bad. Ideas or anything. And I think it has a ripple effect within that person and their family and then their friends, and then it's gonna spread. So I'm very thankful for having seen the presentations and being a part of it.
Got it. All right. And whether you're a spouse, again, to me, it doesn't matter what your background is, right? We're all dealing with this, and a lot of us are faking it, and so hence my advice: stop faking it. It's now the first commandment. It's changed. The commandments have changed since the last time you saw them. And the first one is stop faking it. And it became, and the reason that happened was because of the number of comments that people made to me about that. and, you know, how impactful, you know, the whole faking it thing was. And what I've seen when somebody stands up in front of a whole, and you've seen General Furness do it, right? I mean,
yep.
Stand up there and talk about, you know, what it's like to lose 100 Marines killed under his command, and then talking about, you know, his daughter and their family. And you know, you're watching that right at the start going, I think most people think the same thing, like, I don't know what I just walked into, but this is not like the other things I've seen.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I don't think we're, especially in the Marine Corps, to the point where we need, to the point we need to be where Marines, family members can, you know, say, hey, throw their hand up, say, hey, yeah, I need help. The stigma, to, you know, the stigma is just still there. And, but I think this is the best chance that we have to kind of bridge that gap and get closer to being open about things and just being real, like
yeah,
you say.
I think it all starts with, look, if you look down and you do an honest assessment of it and you look at, you know, where does this all go? To me, it's got to follow a path that leads you to the truth. And then then once we understand the truth, then we can deal with it. And,
yep.
And I think that's significant. All right, Emma, I'm taking up a ton of your time. First of all, I want to thank you for doing this, and I hope you don't mind if in the future I call you up and bring you back on.
I'd love it. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.